Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talk to Jerry Barker of Guelph Speaks, in what I'm sure is a long-awaited grunge match between the friendly blogger and the unfriendly blogger, which, as you will hear, is actually quite cordial with a lot of understanding on various topics. You might know Jerry by reputation, but under the idea that the best way to know someone is to talk to them, I thought for this centenary episode of the show, it might be fun to get someone unexpected like Jerry in the studio. The start of a beautiful friendship is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. So once again, welcome to the 100th episode of the Guelph Politicast. It took us 6 years to get here. It's hard to do something week after week without the infrastructural support of a permanent studio or a staff, or even when people don't get back to you with enough wiggle room in order to make a deadline, but it's all worthwhile, and I know many of you out there love this slice of life in the Royal City, and I thank you for your indulgence, as some weeks it's easier to get out a podcast than others. As for today's show, I want to do something special for the 100th episode, have a guest on that you wouldn't expect, or do something major like a live taping, but I guess that second option will be put on the back burner until episode 200, because for 100, I did something much harder. I reached out to Guelph Speaks blogger Jerry Barker. Now, politicos in Guelph know the name, and they may even know the brand. Jerry covers local matters with a more, shall we say, conservative focus. He's seen by some as an agitator. He's seen by others as an on-point commentator for people concerned about how tax money is spent at City Hall. But to just about everyone else, he's seen as kind of a boogeyman that hates government, government spending, and anything that's not roads, police, and emergency services. Like most people, though, Jerry Barker is more than the sum of his blog. I reached out to the man behind Guelph Speaks and found him very amiable and willing to come on the podcast to talk all about politics and being an independent media type in the city of Guelph. The aim of the show was to not do a typical interrogative kind of interview, but aim for something more conversational. Like the olden days of two guys from competing newspapers sharing notes of the day's work over a cold drink. So, this week on the Guelph Politicast, Jerry Barker and I talk about covering City Hall in our own ways, what we think about some of the various issues going on at Council, some of the points we agree upon, and there are a few, and whether or not Jerry and his associates are going to bring back grassroots Guelph in the next election cycle, which not coincidentally is exactly 1 year from now. So I caught up with Jerry Barker last week in studio. So Jerry Barker, thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome, madam.
And it's a big occasion for me. It's 100 episodes of my podcast. It took 6 years to get here, but we're here now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So this is good for people listening. This is going to be a bit different in that I'm not going to ask you questions, and you're going to there will be questions, of course, but we want this to be more conversational and not an interrogatory or an interrogation or anything like that. So
thank goodness.
Let me just, maybe we can each, to begin with, say where we think the other is coming from, so that, you know, we can maybe understand where we come from in our various sites. I think you're someone who comes from a place, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you are very wily when it comes to where your taxes go. You're a small C conservative, and mm-hmm. your focus is on how government is managed, how government spends tax money, mm-hmm. and you're not so interested in maybe the dynamics of the social planning and how the official plan gets made. And
no, I wouldn't say that.
Okay,
I wouldn't say that, but I think you're pretty well on the right track. What my concern is my wife and I, we both love Guelph, but my concern is that there's been several years of really serious mismanagement, mm-hmm. and I've got a business background to a degree, and I could see it, because one of them I could bring up, for example, was the problem that they had with the new City Hall,
mm-hmm.
and when that was when the general contractor was tossed off the job, literally in 2008. Mm-hmm. Happened to be on my birthday, as a matter of fact, in 2008. That's why I remember. Anyway, the thing is that took 5 years to really sort out, and finally the court sorted it out, and it cost the city a lot of money.
Right.
And one of the problems was there was no on-the-site serious management. I'll put it that way. There was an engineer on there, but
right.
The poor guy was discredited after when the trial was on. But basically, it's all about checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have an administration that's a $500 to $600 million corporation, you have to have checks and balances. And the argument can be made, well, that's up to council. That's what they're there for. They're
right.
Our representatives, my representative. But because of the political atmosphere for those 8 or 9 years in which Mayor Farbridge was in charge, she had total control over her caucus because they were all supporters of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, there was a miscalculation, obviously, and they were shocked to learn that when the judge came out, Judge McKenzie came out and said that they were culpable in wrongfully dismissing the general contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I guess it took about a year later, we found out that the original contract was for $42 million. Well, it ended up costing an additional $23 million.
Right.
Due to changes that were made, 325 changes, orders were made, and it wasn't coordinated. And there was a whole bunch of people got involved, the architects and the bond company and all that sort of thing. So that's that kind of got me going and saying, gee, Willikers, this is not the way it should run. and we know the result of that is
right.
that the mayor was defeated. And as were a number of her councilors, some who left didn't run, but others who were defeated. So I just feel that as a citizen, and I'm a taxpayer, and I just think that we don't have the kind of oversight
right.
that we need in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And the council is still controlled by supporters of the former mayor. And next year, I guess, the rubber will hit the road. We'll know how that turns out.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically that's where I'm coming from. And I call myself a red Tory
mm-hmm.
because I believe that we have to look after the less fortunate people in this world.
Mm.
And I'm not just doing a Trump thing and close everything down and throw everybody off the dole and that sort of thing. So it's really important, that the city is managed carefully
mm-hmm.
and responsibly
mm-hmm.
and still can maintain the services.
Right.
And progressives on the left, they feel that, you can't cut the services. That's bad news. And Pat Fung, he did a very detailed analysis of how the city overhead was too big.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, and he submitted it to council. He was given 5 minutes to present a 19-page, I think it was, report and analysis.
Well, in fairness, everyone's given 5 minutes.
I understand that. Yeah, I understand that. But the thing is, when he left,
right.
I had a friend who was in the council. And when he left, they started mocking him and mocking what he did.
Mm.
And I think that's not good because we're not going to gain anything from that. So
right.
we soldier on and... I know I'm not the most popular person at City Hall, but however, it's still I tried my best with the resources that I have, and I'm a one man gang. I'm not reliant on anybody else.
I feel you on the one man gang part.
Yeah, you know the feeling.
Does it ever bother you that some people look at you like a boogeyman?
No, not really, because I was in the newspaper business for years and years
yeah.
and years, and you're going to be called all kinds of things in that business. And I was working for the largest paper in Canada, the Toronto Star, and I spent had two terms there, and I think that you learn a lot because I started out as just a young guy, a country correspondent, sort of thing, and. And when I left, I was an assistant managing editor, and I'd gone through all kinds of experiences in reporting and commenting and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to know the business pretty well.
All right, I want to get your opinion on me, because you once called me, and I quote, a friendly blogger, and I wasn't sure how to take that. If I was congeal, or if I am a bit too close to the counselors.
You weren't offended, were you?
I wasn't offended, no. I enjoyed it, actually, and Scotty and I, when we do the open source, as we sometimes joke about it, but yeah, I wasn't offended.
Well, I think you I liked your Market Squared thing. I think that's a nice piece of work. A little overwritten sometimes, but however, that's just the editor in me coming up. Yeah. My wife keeps saying to me, she says, it's too long this week. It's way too long.
Okay. About my stuff.
No,
about your
my stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
But
your wife edits your pieces, and you told me that before.
Yeah, she edits them. Yeah. You know, there's an old rule in the business, you know, you never read your own stuff. Mm-hmm. You've got to have somebody else take a look at it. And she's pretty good. You know, she spots stuff that I've missed.
She's tough?
Yeah, sort of. You know, she's more of a practitioner of grammar and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed, I'm always saying to her, okay, what do you think of this? What's your opinion of this? Well, I hope a lot of people read it. So I say, no, I should be talking to a pollster about this to get the real
right.
angle.
So there you go. Yeah. One of the things we were talking about, and one of the things we agree on, is to go back to matters of city council, is, you know, too much secrecy, too much behind closed doors.
That's one of my pet peeves.
And where do you come from on it? Is it you think that, you know, maybe too much business is being done, or is it just, you know, for me, it's just a complete openness. Like, if you want to be open, you have to be open. It's not enough for the mayor to come out at the beginning of the open session and say, we talked about this, this, and this, and we gave staff direction on 1, 2, and we got information on the 3rd. That's not real openness to me. My perspective is, I don't need a blow by blow. I don't need to know who said what, but I think we definitely need to know what decisions are made out of that.
Absolutely.
When they say we give direction, what was that direction?
Well, the root cause of all this is the Ontario Municipal Act,
mm-hmm.
and they have. Three or four areas, maybe more for all I know, in which you can go into closed session. And the obvious one is contract negotiations, real estate deals, that sort of thing that they're doing. I can understand that shouldn't be out in the open. That
right.
should be done in closed session. Then they have this council, they get into a bit of a bad period there where they went into a closed session and they approved four top managers in the city. They approved a total of $98,000 increases. The lowest was 14%, and the highest was 19%. And but they went in, they were in closed session. They, to this day, they've never ever admitted that.
Mm.
I tried to get it opened up, and I was referred to an outfit from London called Amberlee Gravel.
Yeah,
who it turns out are the contracted closed session investigators,
mm-hmm.
and I made my request, and 4 months later, finally, when I bugged the clerk, I got an answer, and they said, no, we're not going to open up the minutes.
Mm.
And a short time after that, in closed session again, council approved bylaw 19995, which is the indemnification bylaw.
Mm-hmm.
That bylaw is very clear. And it says if I or you mm-hmm. attack somebody on any employee or elected official, that their legal expenses are paid by the city.
Right.
That's as much as I'm going to say about that at this point in time.
Yes, that's it. Before the courts.
Yeah, it's before the courts. And so basically, this is the thing that drives me crazy about closed sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Because the public has no control. The procedure is the mayor and the council instructs the clerk to find the reason that they can go into closed session from the Ontario Municipal Act allowable reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the weakness of the whole thing, it's not only Guelph, it's the other 445 municipalities that have to come deal with this.
The last time Amber Gavlin was at council investigating a closed meeting, there was complaints about three closed meetings that had to do with the Brandt Avenue community hub situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the investigator said that, well, in their report and also in front of council, that because
in closed session.
No,
I wouldn't know them if I fell over them.
But no, he said that, you know, because there's a reason to go into closed session doesn't mean that they have to go into closed session.
That's right.
You know, I guess what the council does is erring on the side of caution in case something comes out in the midst of, you know, it's sort of more easy to just go behind closed doors and let everybody speak their mind rather than before someone in the open session, before someone speaks to say, well, I want to say this about that. Is that okay? Which might slow down the process.
But then it becomes political.
Sure.
You see, that's the problem.
Yeah.
If they are dealing with a really angry kind of a situation, they know that if they had this debate in open council, their people would really get upset.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they use that device, I think, to go and hash it all out among themselves.
Mm.
And in a lot of cases, you mentioned that the mayor comes out and makes a statement after, but in a lot of cases, he doesn't say anything. So we don't know what the heck's in there.
Mm.
So I think that we've got a provincial election coming up, and I think that's something that should be very carefully reviewed and tighten it up a little bit so that they just can't arbitrarily say, God, let's go into closed session. We don't want to talk about this in front of everybody. And, you know, clerk, give me a reason. You know, give me a legal reason. Because I look at the agendas, and you can see that it always starts with,
sure,
be a closed session and the clerk, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know, so.
And a lot of it is kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We kind of know what it's about. You know, last year there was a continual closed session item about Guelph Storm negotiations. And I think that was more or less what it said, Guelph Storm negotiations. Well, we know what that's about. That's about, you know, them trying to renegotiate and staying in Guelph and working out of the Selina Center for another few years. And it seems almost silly that, you know, we kind of know what they mean. But then I guess the cracks aren't filled. You know, the news in between, the real meat of the situation in terms of, like, the hard numbers.
Well, justification is one of the things, you know, because they wound up getting an extra $5 million over 10 years that they didn't have to put out. So.
Right.
But then also, I didn't like the idea that it was fostered, too, that they indicated they would leave town then if they couldn't make a better deal with Guelph. And
right.
That's an old saw that they do. How many sports teams do you know that? Oh, look at Calgary, for example. They want to build a new stadium, and they're now mad at the city because the city says, well, wait a minute, these are taxpayers' dollars.
Right.
You know, you're running the show. So.
Well, it might be a bit different in the OHL. I mean, the Brampton team moved to Barrie. That was a couple of years ago.
I thought, you mean the Barrie Colts or no?
No, no, maybe the Battalion, whoever the Battalion is playing for now, or who they were in Brampton.
Yeah, you're right. I'm trying to remember. I don't follow that too much, except every once in a while, periodically check in to see who the good players are and who might get drafted and that sort of thing. I'm a closet sports nut, so.
Maybe not anymore.
And it killed me the other night when New Jersey scored. When the Toronto had five player skaters and they had three and they scored a goal on them, on the Toronto Maple Leafs. I couldn't believe it. There's going to be some shoring up to do there, I can tell you.
Well, I'm not a big hockey guy myself. The only thing I know is if there's a way for the Leafs to not make the playoffs, they will find it.
Yeah, but they've probably got the best coach in the league. That's one of their good things. And so anyway.
We're getting off track, but... I wonder, you said you're a Red Tory, you believe in social programs, but that programs, a lot of people on council think programs shouldn't be cut. I wonder, though, because there are a lot of people looking at from the flip side, and I'm thinking of transit in particular, because a lot of people see what happens at transit, And they said that's a service cut. And they believe that transit is sort of a second-class service that the city runs, that, that perhaps the city isn't as dedicated to transit as they are to, say, cutting the lawns in the parks or keeping the pools filled and open. It's, you know, there are cuts there, and they are council approved. And I know what you're saying, that, you know, by and large, governments don't like to cut, but there have been a history of some cuts.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay.
Because this week there was a release from Guelph Transit that said that their ridership was up 45%
right
in September. Over 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like saying 45% of what?
Yeah.
You know, because this is a heavily subsidized operation.
Right.
And it's the great benefactors are the students at the university. Mm-hmm. And they are, as you may are aware, they have to pay each semester $125 for a pass to use the system. And that's fine. You know, they're paying their way. But I'd like to see a breakdown of the number of people who aren't university people that have the pass and how much they're charged for the pass.
All right.
You see? In other words, get into the nitty-gritty of all this.
Yeah.
So I'm concerned, and I can remember a debate a couple of years ago in which the left said, look, we got to have coverage on the holiday weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the union contract is that they get premium pay for doing that, and the traffic wasn't there because nobody was around. They had the odd event at the park and that sort of thing, but they just weren't using public transit at that time. And that seemed to just didn't make any difference. We've got to have those buses up and down the
– right.
Down, and then this realignment, I think, is probably going to be – it's working pretty well, I think, and I think they've done the right thing there. But the biggest cost of Guelph Transit is the labor. That's
well, I think that's the biggest cost of any service is the labor.
It's still a biggie.
Sure.
And what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, the internal auditor, Loretta Alonzo, she did a study of all of the overtime that the city had involved in. It was $5 million. And $1 million of it was Guelph Transit.
Yeah.
And she didn't come right out and say it, but there were games being played with the rules to you get the overtime or you I won't come in you and then well you somebody will have to come in and cover for me because I'm sick or whatever.
Right.
All kinds of angles.
Sure.
And so that's why I'm a little concerned that.
But there was also another side of it too, that the transit driver contract lays out in pretty explicit terms what services they do and for what pay levels, and this was in the midst of changes being made to the system and to routes and adding things like the stat holiday service without having that addressed in the contract. So when all else fails, they go to the overtime spectrum, and so that applies to things like the magic bus and, you know, running the late night bus to and from downtown to the university area, things like the stat holiday service, late night service, what have you. And that was the other side of it too, is just kind of structural, because the one thing you know with union workers is that they like to hold to where to their the job description is outlined in the contract.
They negotiated a deal.
Right.
They don't want to roll back the contract.
Exactly.
I was a steward in a union, so I know exactly what that's all about. But the thing is that this you have to have transit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand. I live up in the North End, and I see this bus going by and on residential street you know, every day and every hour or whatever it is. Not a soul on it. Not a soul. Great, big, huge urban bus.
Mm-hmm.
And I often wonder, why don't they experiment with some smaller buses that – I don't know whether there'd be any savings or not, because I don't know what their cost base is. So, but
sure.
It just seems to me that I hear more people tell me that. Why are they running around all over the place with all these empty buses? And they don't realize that, you know, this from this institution alone, you know, it's
right.
Up and down behind where all the student housing is and that sort of thing. It's performing what it's supposed to do.
I hear what you're saying, but the thing I find with this bus is empty sort of Where's Waldo thing is that, you know, yeah, you may see along your stretch of street, it may be an empty bus, but then it'll go around the corner and then it'll pick up 10 people. It's, you know, and there's also time of day. I came down here on the 41 Express and there was about 8 other people on the bus, but then we might be between classes.
Adam.
Yes.
You are a bus expert. And I feel at a disadvantage at this point in time.
since you know we're talking about budget stuff, that the budget is coming up. I guess the way I cover it is, you know, I basically transcribe what's going on.
Yeah.
But you're going to cover it in your way. So what are you looking for?
Well, I will probably go to a couple of the meetings, particularly the public meetings, and I like to go the day they finally finalize it, which is always an interesting situation. because this is in an election year, this budget is in an election year, there'll be some goodies in there. They did that in 2014, and it didn't work out too well, but however... my perspective, anyway.
Or depending on who was sitting where, yeah.
So I just feel that this is a very important budget.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that they've so much money has been wasted.
Mm.
The whole green energy, initiative, the
district energy
initiative,
yeah.
That was just a dead. Loss and that thing. I mean, loss. Big money.
Yeah, and I think you'll have a tough time finding people who would disagree.
Well, the point is that once that money's gone,
you can't
build a new library. You can't build a South End.
Right.
Because the capital budget is zilch. And as a matter of fact, the CAO, Derek Thompson, has said that They established a 10-year capital budget program, and he says we're already $170 million behind. You know, I start to get a little bit nervous about that because he's the guy that's running the show.
Right.
And I don't know. I just think that I go back to the Pat Fung report. He says you don't have to cut services.
Mm.
He says if you do the following things, and he named them. He said if you cut these not services but these overhead items, then you'll have more than enough. You'll save $20 million a year, and you'll be able to put the money to the infrastructure, which is another very, very important thing, and that it's future councils are going to be saddled with that as far as the eye can see.
Sure.
So anyway, Pat came up with this, and then they just decided no. The other thing is that the local newspaper, I use that term loosely, he went to see them and he said, here's the story. Oh, well, we haven't got the resources or the time to investigate that. That'll take a month.
Yeah.
And he said, I've got all the data. It's all the data from the city of Guelph and the BEMA consultant report. Well, we can't do it. He says, get it. If you can boil it down to 400 words, we might consider it.
Mm.
So... I thought that was pretty bad, you know. And they just didn't want to do it. And they didn't. They never did. Never reported on it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Then I attempted to have an ad. We'd buy the ad. I went out and raised money to run the ad, half-page ad in the paper. And they said, no, we're not going to do it because it's inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I guess we have a difference of opinion there. it never ran in the local paper.
Mm.
And there are all kinds of things that they write all kinds of stories of which are press releases from the communication department. I look at them. I know where they came from. And
right.
They have somebody, little gnome in there, or even copy it and post it and put it in the paper for all I know. I don't know whether they're rewriting it. Doug Hallett was a pretty good reporter, but it was policy, corporate policy, not to rock the boat. And the reason is, and this is my theory, and it's never been disputed, but you know, they're getting it's a huge advertising contract for that paper, for the so-called city news,
right?
Where they put notices in how to put a brick in your toilet to save water, and you know, and watch it pick up after your dog, and use the green bin, stupid, not the brown one. You know, this to me is all public service stuff.
Sure,
you know, and but we're paying for it. People pay for it. And I don't know. I think it's probably years ago, I think it was about $250,000, but I think it's way up there now. Because I bought ads in the Tribune, and I know what they cost. But they're big clients. I reckon they probably get about 5 pages a week.
Yeah,
full pages and some partials, but you know, and that's good revenue for them.
Well,
so they're not going to rock that boat.
No.
Never, ever.
No, but it's good revenue. But perhaps where I might disagree is, one, there are a lot of people who complain that the city doesn't do enough communicating. So
be still my heart.
But this is the thing I hear sitting at council, and people come, especially for these planning meetings, where there's an eight-story mid-rise going up, you know, in the next street over, and people are like, I just found out about this yesterday.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and so it's I feel a bit fussy taking away, you know, one line of communication. On the other hand, though, where can the city has to do this stuff? You know, especially for planning meetings.
Absolutely.
But there's no other paper they can go to now.
That's right.
So, isn't this like maybe mutually assured destruction if one of them
it's a good way of putting
steps
it,
out of line that, you know, the Tribune can, you know, attack the city if it sees fit, knowing that, you know, there's no other newspaper that the city can put their pages in.
I'm not saying attack.
Okay.
I'm saying cover.
Okay.
Cover the news.
All right.
You know, I think they've got, what, 5 people now, or maybe 4 people. I've lost sort of count of the number of people they've got working there.
I think
in the editorial area.
Yeah, I think on the news beat they have Jessica and Graham and
Chris Cito.
Chris
and Lovell, whatever her name is.
Jessica.
So that's 3 plus the editor. That's 4. So
yeah,
because he's even writing in the paper now. I noticed he had a column the other day. Now it's unfortunate because you know, the Mercury I think really filled. There was balance there. So Metroland, in its wisdom, said, "Oh no, we're losing our shirts on this thing. Besides, the real estate's worth more money," and they did it. They just closed her down, and now I guess there's going to be a high rise going up behind the Albion Hotel. I don't know, but the thing is that a newspaper has a responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just there to be a moneymaker, and that's the Metroland. I've dealt with Metroland in a previous. Part of my career.
Right.
I know what they're like.
Yeah.
You know, they want those heavy sections with all the food ads in them and everything else. We got ours today, as a matter of fact, and my wife brought it in, and I said, okay, I'll just take the paper itself, put the rest of the stuff over in the garbage. We never even look at it. And I don't know. I mean, they've got a fair circulation, I would think. Because
somebody must, though. Somebody must look at New and Holmes.
Oh no! I think they look at the ads. I think the ads.
Okay.
The ads become news,
right?
Where as opposed to newspaper is supposed to publish the news and
yeah
and it what annoyed me was that Doug Coxon was quoted as saying in that Globe piece a month or so ago. He said, "Oh yeah, we're going to be doing more investigative reporting," and I nearly fell off the chair because that was just an out and out lie. That's not their style. They don't want to rock the boat.
It's also not, I don't think, ever been the mandate because, as you said, it's a community paper, and a community paper doesn't.
I ran a community paper for about 11 years, and we were always after stories.
Okay,
we were always chasing stories. You know, you just don't take the handout all the time,
right?
And I mean, that was a little different situation for me because I was in a very small town then, and I was quite dependent on the 2 grocery stores for their advertising and that sort of thing.
So having said that, do you feel the pressure to fill the void? Because I sometimes feel that pressure.
Yes.
The Scientology story.
Yeah, I didn't.
I mean, that's not your bag, but I'm using it as an example for me.
Yeah.
The you know, they got the exact same statement, the Today and the Tribune that I got when I reached out to Scientology, which is like, oh, we're moving to 40 Baker. It's all good. It's just administrative. It's okay. And they kind of run that, and then that's that. Because then there's an article, there's a post. Whereas I got that and then used that as sort of launching pad to talk to, you know, the people in Guelph who aren't fans. I talked to Edward Pickersgill about how it affects, you know.
He was the guy that engineered it, wasn't he? He pulled his center out of there. So they,
well, he didn't pull out. He was evicted out after everybody else left.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I didn't know the procedure.
Yeah. But you know, I see posts like that. And I'm just like, well, that's, you know, it doesn't add any sort of local insight. It doesn't add any, you know, how the community feels. It doesn't add to, you know, the general concerns about Scientology. What is a CLO? What does it do exactly? You know, saying that this is a Continental Liaison Office doesn't say anything to me. I had to talk to, you know, Tony Ortega and a former member of the Sea Org to kind of get a full understanding of it. But and that's just what I find problematic. It's kind of like you get your quotes, you get the five W's, you plop it online, and then that's that.
Well, the question I would ask about the Scientology Church,
yes,
that's in the title.
Sure.
Are they paying taxes?
Yeah. It's a great
Maybe
question.
Maybe that's why they moved here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they don't have to pay taxes because it's a church. It's a religious organization. It's not, as far as I'm concerned.
Not in Canada, it's not.
Well,
it's a religious-based charity in Canada.
Yeah.
Which means they still have to.
Yeah. They're obviously renting there. I don't think they didn't buy the building.
Yeah,
so.
2 years.
But I'd be interested in that because it's, when you look around this city and see the number of buildings of which there's no taxation, not only churches, but city-owned buildings, all of the thing, the people, the buildings, the people own. So that's not generating any tax. It's zero. And here at the university, I think you're probably quite familiar with the way this works, with the infamous bed tax deal, where each undergraduate, and I don't know whether the graduate students are subject to this or not.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
And but, you know, I worked it out. I did the math on based on 20,000, I think it was, and I figured it's total property tax in lieu of the regular taxing by our own taxing authority was $1.6 million. This is the biggest property owner in Guelph. You know, so virtually, we're kind of in a backward way. We're subsidizing it because we have to supply the police services, EMS, fire, you know. All the, and sewage and all that sort of thing, they have to use city services. So what do we get? $1.6 million a year.
It could be argued,
won't even buy a new fire truck.
But it could be argued, too, that it comes back to the community in different ways because the U of G is the city's largest employer.
I don't know whether it is or not. I was stunned the other day to find out that Linamar and their 19 plants here employ 6,000 people.
Yeah.
Holy smoke! And they're paid privately. They're not university people, and the employees here are all paid by the public purse.
Sure,
and plus and tuition fees and the things that come in. But this is a big operation.
Yeah,
I was driving around. It was a learning experience for me. Let me tell you, I was just amazed at what they've done here. Because when was it? My first exposure to this was about. My golly, it was about 25 years ago. And my wife was taking a university course. I used to dump her off at on the hill there on College View.
Oh, yeah.
So she could go in to have her class. And it was you know, small. It looked to me quite small. And but wow, did it ever grow. Wow.
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous asset to the city. I totally agree. But it's got to be fair, you know. Because the problem we've got, Adam, is the assessment of this city is 84% residential and 16% industrial commercial. And that should be probably 60-40.
Right.
That's what it should be. And in the 8 years that the Farbridge administration was running the show, it never changed, and it hasn't changed in the last 3 years. It's still the same ratio. Mm-hmm. You look around and say, oh, God, there's a new Starbucks. Or there's they're putting that Longo's store down there. Oh, boy, this is fantastic. Well, meanwhile, the Sears store just dropped 100 jobs, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And so it's not just about jobs. It's about assessment.
Right.
Because then the industrial commercial people take on, if they can grow, it takes on a greater proportion of the assessment that we need. And it's assessment that makes the city run.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the council is counting on the assessment. And I, for the life of me, I cannot understand why it hasn't changed in, 10 years now. Still the same one.
Could it be that residential growth outpaces industrial growth? So that while things get, you know, more, that the ratio ends up staying the same.
But the ratio is, you can build these places down there off Clare Road and all those developments,
right,
which are high density. And that's a bonus for the city, by the way, because they get more tax revenue from that kind of situation. But as they go up and the other one grows up more slowly.
Yeah.
So that ratio is still stuck in the same area.
Right.
And I think that's, I've looked at other municipalities and a lot of them are 50-50.
Mm.
But we don't have a Toyota plant here, for example.
No.
And that changes the situation.
It changes the metrics. I don't know. I have a feeling you're probably, given everything we've talked about, you are an industry, you know, sort of first,
the ratio would change, that's all.
Right, but you want to see the solutions come. You don't want to see the government trying to formulate a way to make it work, right? That your feeling is that government is going to handle something clumsily versus the way something the private sector can, especially in terms of economic growth.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
Because the private sector has nothing to say about what the planning has done and what I mean, we're paying a guy $150,000 a year to for an economic development and I look around and say, when are we going to get a Toyota or a Kia or some big operation or a series of smaller ones?
Right.
I've got a very good friend who has a machine shop business which feeds into Linamar because he makes parts for Linamar.
Okay.
And he says it's just getting tougher and tougher and tougher because, you know, to keep the employees that he needs to do the job it's just hasn't grown the way he'd hoped.
Mm.
But Linamar it's done pretty well, I think.
Well, yeah.
But boy, be wary of Mr. Trump and scrapping NAFTA, which will include the auto industry agreement that was the precursor of NAFTA.
Right.
And if he closes it down, boy, and starts putting tariffs up, 35% right, for Canadian auto parts and Canadian vehicles, what do you do? You know?
That's a good question.
He could destroy our industry.
Well, he could destroy his own industries, too. There's so much symbiosis between the American-Canadian auto industry.
And they're in the northern U.S. states.
Yeah.
And they're shipping a lot of stuff into Canada. And they're the first guys going to say, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
You just cut off our customer. They just put a bunch of barriers up, tariff barriers. And he will destroy free trade as we know it in North America, unless he stops somehow. And I'm just wondering who the heck's going to stop him, you know.
It's a good question.
You know, when Senator Corker says that it's the White House is like an adult daycare center, you know, you have to say, oh, wow. And it's going to affect us.
No doubt.
Go right down to the municipal level as well.
No doubt. I there was the press conference yesterday in the Oval Office, and the camera was focused on Trump, so I couldn't see any of Trudeau's reactions at all. But it was, you know, Trump was going on about how he's going to look at pulling NBC's license and fake news and all this
he
and
doesn't understand
nuclear
it.
Missile. No, he does. Well, he doesn't understand. But I feel myself having enormous sympathy for Justin Trudeau and having to deal with this.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, they're in the president of Mexico, too, Peña Nieto, because we have people who supposed to rationally understand the effects of what these agreements mean. And the thing with the nuclear proliferation story is that Trump doesn't even know the basics of, you know, reaching an agreement to draw down nuclear weapons means. But well, it's nice we can all agree that we hate Trump.
Boy, oh boy. I understand 65% of Americans hate the guy.
Yeah.
But he keeps going out to his base and
saying,
I promise you this in my campaign and I'm going to come through. Except the health thing was a disaster. Absolute disaster.
The thing that boggles, I mean, there's so much to bother you about Donald Trump, but the thing that I keep coming back to, and you should be able to appreciate this, but his reputation as a business person, which is completely made up.
Yeah.
It's based on a fiction made for his reality show that he's this genius business person, because the record doesn't show that.
Yeah. Look what he did in Atlantic City. And he stiffed all the workers on the Taj Mahal.
Yes.
And he walked away from it, and they all lost millions, for gosh sakes, those poor guys that worked there and built the place.
Yeah.
He stiffed them all.
Oh, yeah. Well, and not the only ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he's not a nice man. But,
but that's the worst we can say. But
well, I worry about the situation in Guelph. If he indeed does tear up NAFTA,
sure,
that's going to affect 6,000 people that work here,
or more.
If they can't ship the stuff that they're making, and you know what just in time is all about, eh?
Mm-hmm.
That the truck arrives just when they're starting to build the first line in the morning. And the parts are there waiting for them.
Right.
And it was something, I worked for Magna for a while, and I got a real education in how this just-in-time delivery works and how it's so slick the way they do it.
Yeah.
That's because the trucks just cross the border at Detroit.
Yeah.
That's the highest border crossing in North America.
Absolutely.
Is at Detroit. And then these guys own the bridge. They tried to stop the Canadian government from building a new bridge, and I don't know what's going to happen there.
That's something I haven't heard about recently. I remember that, though, the ambassador, people who own the Ambassador Bridge. It's kind of weird that this major bridge is sort of owned by a private person.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a little weird.
Poor old Detroit, went through a bad, bad period, and they just say, we need the money, or I don't even know who owned it, because it was a bridge built from one country to another, so somebody had to own it, I guess, or the governments had to jointly own it, and they sold it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bad news. Bad news.
I do kind of want to wind things down, but I did want to ask you one particular question in regards to the election coming up, the local election. You were part of Grassroots Guelph in 2014. Yes. If you thought about bringing that back or rallying that again?
Well, it's still out there. I mean, we have... we're an incorporated body and a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I'm going to step aside as the executive director, and I'm one of the officers of the corporation. But I want to concentrate on other things, and it's time for new blood to come in.
Mm.
But we're going to call a meeting and say, okay, where do we go from here? What are we going to do? They've changed the rules quite a bit.
Mm.
I don't know whether you're up on them or not. If you are, I'd love to know what they are. But apparently, corporations are going to be limited to the amount of money that they can give to a campaign candidate. And the same thing with the unions. They can't bring in a lot of money. And that's going to affect the...
That's the new provincial rules?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was as a result of those soirees that Premier Wynne was having, and where they invite all these people, charge $10,000 a table, and she was called out on it, and so her government changed it.
Yeah,
they changed it. So I don't know how that's going to roll out, but Grassroots Guelph, I've had some preliminary discussions, but basically we've been in hiatus. We haven't done anything, but it's sitting there. We've got a website and we've got a bank account and we've got an organization such as it is, but, times change. That was like 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether the guys and gals want to go into the lists again to do it, but I'm kind of hoping so, because I think it's an important time. The tough thing is to encourage good candidates.
Mm-hmm.
People who, what I would call centrists, in other words, they're not this far and not this far.
Right.
Down the center, because in Canada, centrist politicians and centrist governments always succeed. But, you know, as soon as you have a radical change, then it doesn't work. And we've witnessed that in a way right here in Guelph in the last 8 or 9 years.
Mm.
So I don't know whether that makes any sense or not. I'm trying.
I know that doing the podcast is a new experience for you. And, you know, as you said, you come from the newspaper background. So this media landscape must look like Mars at times. But
yeah, I was going to ask you if you could help me on this. Well, you got that right.
Well, I hope this was a good experience, and I'm glad we were able to team up and do something like this. And
I've enjoyed it very much.
And, good.
I think that you know, it's these are the kinds of discussions that they should be having on the municipal level.
Yeah,
you know, it's give and take on the thing.
Sure.
And so I don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but thanks very much for inviting me.
And I'll try to keep it brief in today for you.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay.
And once again, that was Jerry Barker, and you can check out Jerry's site at guelphspeaks.wordpress.com. As for Guelph Politicast, here's a programming note for you, a reminder. At the end of the month, the Politicast is going to go down to every other week as we get into the busy budget season, and then hopefully back to weekly after the beginning of the year. Those plans are being developed still at the moment, so stay tuned for more information about that in the weeks ahead. And that is it for this 100th edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can also reach me through adamadonaldson on Instagram, or go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And I'd like to take this opportunity to offer a special salute to the 22 people that give to Guelph Politico every month. It is through your generosity that makes all of this possible on a weekly basis. So thank you very, very much. In the meantime, for all of this local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we'll have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.